Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Anthony Shadid and three of his colleagues at the New York Times were captured last month in Libya by forces loyal to Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. They were beaten, passed from group to group in the midst of battle, threatened with death. Before it was over, they had seen Libya from behind rebel lines, as prisoners of Colonel Gaddafi's forces, and from the heart of Gaddafi's compromised regime. This hour on Point, Anthony Shadid on that captivity, on the battle in Libya, and the unfinished turmoil right now in the Arab world. Joining me now in the studio is Anthony Shadid, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, correspondent for the New York Times. On March 15th, Shadid and three colleagues from the Times were captured by Gaddafi forces at the eastern gate of Ajdabiya in Libya. They were released on March 21st. He's with me in the studio right now, Anthony Shadid. Welcome back to On Point. It's especially good to see you this time.
Thank you. Yeah, it's good to be here.
There's so much to talk about in this hour in Libya and right across this region, which you know so very well. But just to look straight at it, take us back to that moment. You're driving along. Where were you? What were you doing? So many colleagues all together. And what happened at that checkpoint in Ajdabiya?
You know, we were thinking when we got there that morning that this battle for Ajdabiya was going to be somehow decisive. It was going to be a moment that kind of, you know, decided which direction the rebellion against Colonel Gaddafi was going to go. I think given what we saw as the stakes of that battle, we may have stayed a little bit too long. The battle had started. We were finally leaving the city. You know, it was before dusk, around 4:30, headed toward Benghazi.
Who was holding the town at this time? Was it the rebels who had it and Gaddafi's people were trying to get back in?
You know, that was our idea, is that they were coming from the west, and that's what we had seen in previous towns in Ras El Hanouf and Brega, that they would attack from the west. The attack would last days and then the city would fall.
And you'd have time
before
to scoot back out the east, if necessary, back toward behind rebel lines.
Exactly. And what had happened that day, though, was the city had become encircled. That Gaddafi's forces had encircled the city. So as we headed toward Benghazi, toward the east, we stumbled on a checkpoint almost immediately upon leaving the town. And Lindsay, the photographer, she saw it first, and you know, we weren't sure what to make of it. She said those are government troops. It seemed like minutes, but it was probably only seconds, and we hit that checkpoint. Our driver yelled "journalists," and you know, those soldiers had that mix of, I think, you know, a lot of people have seen that mix of fear and rage in their faces, and they took us out of the car. And you know, again, it was almost instantaneous. Rebels attacked the checkpoint where we had been stopped at, and there was, you know, the fiercest firefight that I ever seen, the fiercest gun battle I had ever seen, and we basically ran for our lives.
So you've been taken by Gaddafi forces at this point with that fear and rage on their face at you, journalists, because you're putting this story out to the world, and they have some sense of what that means. And as they're taking you, rebels are attacking them, and you're in the middle of it all.
That's right. And, you know, I stumbled. I hit a sand berm, fell down, and I saw Tyler, the photographer. He was running, and for a split second I thought he was going to make a run for it, that he was actually going to try to escape, and I probably would have followed him, but instead he veered behind a kind of a one-room shack, basically. It was a concrete building, and you know, we tried to take cover there from the gun battle. You know, again, within seconds, you know, the soldiers, you know, set upon us and you know, emptied everything out of our pockets and forced us on the ground.
There you are with two Times photographers, Lindsay Addario and Tyler Hicks, and with another Times correspondent, Stephen Farrell. What were those next few days like before you got to Tripoli?
You know, it was that, I tell you, that first 12 hours to me was the most harrowing, where, you know, again, we got behind that concrete shack. We did think we were going to die. As it wore on, it was more a sense of the unknown, you know, a fear of what was going to come next, of you know, of whether anyone knew about us. And I remember getting, at one point, a couple of days later, we were in a jail cell in a town called Sirte, Colonel Gaddafi's hometown. And I remember this interrogation going on and them trying to learn our names and their inability to pronounce our names. As I went back to that jail cell, I told my colleagues, no one has any idea where we are.
There you are, kind of buried in the midst of this rebellion and the counterattack by the Gaddafi forces. I've got tape of your colleagues, and I just want to listen to it. It kind of lays out the arc of your time there. And, of course, this is an experience that they very much shared with you, bound and unbound, blindfolded and not blindfolded. One young woman plus you, three guys. Here's Lindsay Addario, photographer, describing in a New York Times video how she was treated by Gaddafi forces in eastern Libya.
In Libya, it was incredibly surprising to me how I was treated. I have never been punched in the face before. This was the first time in my life I've had a man look me in the eye and punch me in the face. And especially when I was bound, hands and feet. And at some point, the second time I was punched, I was also blindfolded. So for me, that was astonishing.
And this was not a group that was unaccustomed to rough circumstances of reporting and shooting film, Tony.
You know, and what it showed me, Tom, was that, I mean, time and again, we were met with, you know, utter just, I mean, brutality might be too strong a word, but it was rough. As time would wear on then, I would always kind of feel like this society or this culture, you know, it almost drawn its deeper instincts for generosity and hospitality. And
the reaction often whacking you around, rifle butt in the back of the head, the death threats, Lindsay groped, she said, everywhere you could be groped.
That's right. And then, you know, and then hours later, we'd be offered dates, for instance, or water. You know, and I think it was symptomatic. It said something about just what the society, the trauma the society has gone through, having dealt with 4 decades of, you know, Colonel Gaddafi's utterly bizarre rule. It's disfigured the place at some level.
And right now, everything just kind of up in the air, looking for any sense of order must have been, I guess at some point you're looking for that when you're a captive. Here's Tyler Hicks, a photographer, talking about that time and that sort of just being passed from group to group almost randomly through the desert.
Within seconds of leaving a group of opposition fighters, we were captured by government soldiers. And in a flash, you saw you're transferred from one to the next. And you could see that the guys on the other side of that hill were just as poorly trained and unable to make decisions and without any order whatsoever. And this was quite upsetting, actually, when we were caught, because at that time, you want to be with some authority. You want a hierarchy.
Not just out in the kind of Blade Runner madness of what's been running back and forth there. You've reported on this conflict, and you've been held captive by Gaddafi forces. We've heard so much about who they are. What did you see? What have you seen in your reporting? We've heard mercenaries. We've heard Libyans from the far south. We've heard all kinds of tribal conflict and even family elements woven into this. Who's still fighting for Muammar Gaddafi?
You know, I think you nailed it right there at the end, this idea of family elements. It struck me, you know, soon after we were captured that these soldiers kept referring to the doctor. And, I was trying to figure out who this doctor was. And then finally they referred to Dr. Mu'tasim, who was one of Colonel Gaddafi's sons, considered a hardliner. Mm-hmm. And it did look like we were in the hands of his militia, his brigade, however you want to describe it. They call it a brigade, but it does operate, I think, more as a militia. It was difficult to see how, you know, the rank, you know, who was the commander. Mm-hmm. It was difficult to see kind of, you know, with the depth of organization, you know, within this militia. But it was clear that their loyalty was to one of his sons, to Colonel Gaddafi's sons. What struck me, Tom, I'll tell you, as a journalist, was how, you know, how much these soldiers seemed to believe the propaganda of the regime. In other words, they did, I think, sincerely believe they were fighting al-Qaeda. They were fighting Islamist fanatics. And they told us as much. And, you know, I didn't expect that, to be honest. I thought they would probably be fighting for money, security, you know, the perks of, you know, of serving the government. There may have been that, but it was clear that they did believe that their fight was against something that they saw very threatening and that they saw very sinister.
You were the Arabic speaker here. I mean, they looked at you and they called you out right away on that when you were speaking Arabic. Then it said spy. Tell us your background. Remind us, Anthony Shadid. I mean, where did you come by your Arabic? And in your reporting life, had you ever been in a situation like this one before?
You know, my family is Lebanese, and I've studied Arabic for many years. Mm-hmm. You know, going back to college on. And it's often, I tell you, that encounter that I had at that very first checkpoint is something that I've often seen in the Arab world, and I think it's a sad statement in some ways of the Middle East. It's often more dangerous to be an Arab than a foreigner in the region, and you know the reasons for that. You know, I'm sure that's a graduate school seminar, but it was this time. You know, the same thing happened again
when they realize you're Arab and by background, but you're working for,
that's right,
whatever,
the foreigners,
the global journalism foreigners.
Yeah, that makes me a spy, in other words. And they said that you're the translator, you're the spy, you're the dangerous one. Mm-hmm. And you know, immediately when I heard that, I knew that, you know, speaking Arabic is not going to help a lot here. So, you know, I tried to stumble with the Arabic. I tried to sound, you know, with as much, you know, I speak with an American accent anyway, but tried to make it even more so. It was terrifying. I think, you know, you're you're stuck in these, you know, this quandary of, you know, you have to speak Arabic to communicate at some level with your captors. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, speaking Arabic makes you immediately suspect and probably endangers your situation a little bit more.
Did you fear for your life?
You know, only, Tom, only at that those first mm-hmm. few hours. They forced us on the ground. We were on our knees, and I felt okay on our knees. But then at one point, a kind of a tall, lanky soldier said, "Get down on your stomachs." Mm-hmm. And at that moment, you know, it's happened once before in my life. But at that moment, you kind of have this almost, it's a sinking feeling, a sense of resignation. That
there's something dehumanizing about it. I mean, once you're just laid out there like firewood.
And I think you have to be dehumanized for people mm-hmm. to commit violence like that. And, you know, when we were laying on our stomachs, I did think it was over for a moment.
How many days in total?
It was 7 days, you know, between our capture and our release.
Anthony Shadid taken captive along with Lindsay Addario, Tyler Hicks, and Stephen Farrell, all colleagues at the Times. Here's Farrell talking about witnessing three Libyas in those days. The first, that of the rebels, he called them a rabble in retreat. We'll think about where they are now. The second, of Gaddafi forces in eastern Libya who kicked and punched and finally delivered the three to Libya. And then there was that third, I should say, to deliver them to Tripoli, where they saw that third and maybe final Libya.
Suddenly, we found ourselves in the third Libya, in the heart of Colonel Gaddafi's regime, in marble-floored, wood-paneled ministry buildings with urbane diplomats in perfect, impeccable English, assuring us that we wouldn't be beaten, assuring us that they were a regime, that they should be taken seriously as such by the international community. They wanted legitimacy, and all the time we're thinking, yeah, but on the far rim, on the outer spiral of your regime, your edge of control, your men are beating and kicking and punching and a rabble. And it was a very rare insight for Western journalists into a country that few have seen for decades now.
Anthony Shadid, colleague Stephen Farrell there, talking about their time passing through those different layers of Libyan society right now, and urbane indeed. You, in writing up the captivity, you quote one of the foreign ministry officials there, quoting Yeats as he sat with you in his office murmuring, "Those that I fight, I do not hate. Those that I guard, I do not love." Wow, Yeats in the middle of what, civil war now in Libya?
Yeah, I was just dumbfounded when it was a conversation that Steve had with that foreign ministry official. Sheesh. They had both gone to the same university, and it mm-hmm. was just, I mean, I heard that, those two lines, and it really did strike you what was afoot here. I mean, it's hard to overstate the impact that 4 decades of Colonel Gaddafi's rule has had on this country. I mean, he portrayed this as 4 decades of perpetual revolution. It was never that, but what it was at some degree was managed chaos. And I think we're dealing with the repercussions of that. There is, I think, underway already a reckoning, you know, with that kind of chaotic rule. Mm-hmm. And it's a bad, I have to say, I think it's not a good indicator for the future either.
Put us in the timeline here. We have all seen the coalition that came in with the no-fly zone. Your release was March 21st. How did that happen? How does that fit in the timeline of those first bombs dropped by French, then British, then American fighters?
You know, when we arrived in Tripoli after 3 days basically on the road, we kind of almost fell to the floor in this, what we later learned was a military intelligence compound. And from that moment on, we were treated quite well, I have to say. We were, you know, fed well, treated well, the accommodations were good. Our fear at that was just how long this was going to drag on, these diplomatic negotiations. And like you pointed out, the bombing started, I think, on the second day we were in Tripoli. Mm-hmm. We could hear it in the compound. We heard mostly the anti-aircraft fire, but you could hear explosions as well.
From the outside, I have to say, those of us worried about you were afraid that would be it. Now the bombing's begun. They're not going to let them go. They'll hold them as chits.
Absolutely. That was our fear, too. And, you know, when you have nothing else to do but talk with your colleagues and being journalists who love to mm-hmm. imagine the worst possible scenario, I mean, we were thinking it would be weeks, even months, that we were going to be stuck in this place. There was never an indication that was going to be the case. No one ever said anything threatening to us at that point. And it turned out that, you know, it really was just a matter of negotiations. But I think fear got the better part of us those days.
Turkish representatives played a very important role here.
That's right, they did. And, you know, you have to give credit to the Turks across the Middle East. They are just they're formidable diplomats. You see that in Iraq. You see that in Syria, elsewhere. And they were, you know, in Libya as well. They maintained, you know, Turkish diplomats have the advantage of being able to maintain contacts with almost everyone, and they're quite skillful at it.
We've got callers for you, Tony Shadid. Let's turn to them. Jim in Williamsburg, Kentucky. Jim, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Anthony Shadid.
Hi, Tom. I was just wondering a few things. In my mental outlook of that area. Life is very cheap over there, very, very cheap. And I wonder if the tables had been turned, and instead of being captured by Gaddafi's people, you had been, say, stopped at a rebel checkpoint and suspected of being of working for the other side. Would you perhaps have been treated differently? And I just think the way the rules of engagement over there, if you're perceived as an enemy, then there are no holds barred.
Jim, let us pick it up. And, I mean, there's a number of pieces there. Let's just start with the first one. Life is cheap over there. Is that your observation? I mean, we've seen them mourn as people mourn all over the world when death comes.
You know, I think it's the opposite, in fact. I think, you know, I think Arab culture has a very deep respect for life. And I think that sense of, like I said earlier, generosity, of hospitality, in some ways, you know, ensured that we were treated better than we might have been otherwise. I mean, we very well could have been spies. I mean, all of us remarked that, you know, this New York Times story that came out about the CIA having people on the ground, you know, basically spotting.
You were out by the time
came
out, but
if that story had come out when we were still in captivity, I mean, there were grounds for suspicion. There's no question about that. But I think that sense, and I think a sense within the culture, within the religion, that you have to treat prisoners well, got us off probably better than we should have.
Though we can't overlook, I mean, you describe in some detail in the four of you and your account of what went on, there were plenty of times where you were whacked and bound and circulation cut off, and this was not sort of a Geneva Code treatment.
It was not, and you know, and I first and foremost, our driver, you know, we don't know the fate of our driver either, and he may have been killed. I don't think he was. If he was killed, I don't think he was executed. I think he may have been caught in that gun battle that erupted early on, but we don't know about his fate either. I mean, I don't want to underplay what happened, but I also don't want to read some kind of that there was some kind of essential viciousness in this culture that delivered us our treatment.
And on the rebel side, our impression is from the outside that the rebels are seeing both the intervention by Tomahawk missiles and bombers, as even when they, over this weekend or early in the weekend, sometimes die under those bombs. Have they welcomed that? Have they welcomed the journalists as well? Are you in any danger in rebel territory in Libya these days?
You know, that's a good question, Tom. I think we saw that kind of the treatment by rebels shift over time. In the beginning, it was almost euphoric. They were welcoming us there. They were savvy enough to understand that we were going to be, I hate to put it in these terms, but we were the vehicle to get their message out. As time went on and as the rebels kept retreating, you saw them trying to limit our access, stop us at roadblocks, not let us get near the front to find out what was really going on.
Why? Because they weren't winning?
That's right. It was basically that. You know, it was, both sides trying to kind of manage the message in their own ways, sometimes viciously, sometimes, a little bit more opportunistically. And again, when we're talking about the rebels, the opposition, these are kind of journalistic shorthands that probably overstate what they really are. As Steve mentioned in his passage that you played, it really was kind of a rabble. And I think even when we talk about the opposition leadership in Benghazi, it's amateurish, it's divided, there are charges of opportunism at play. I don't think we're looking in the near term, even the medium term, to a very positive outlook in Libya.
Wow. Let's go to Stephen in Windham, Connecticut. Stephen, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks, Tom, for taking my call. I happened to talk to Stephen Farrell over the weekend on C-SPAN, and he wove such a tale of horror. It was so captivating. But my question is, on the rebels, what are their political goals? What is their political ultimate goal?
Big question. Unresolved question, even in, as far as we can tell, the innermost circles of policymaking in Washington.
Yeah, that's right. I met computer engineers who would have been probably considered themselves, liberal secularists. I met, Islamists who had been in jail, had fought in Afghanistan, had fought Gaddafi in the 1990s in a place called Derna in eastern Libya. It is a real mix. And I think the one thing that unifies them right now is the end of Colonel Gaddafi's rule, the end of four decades of rule that has, I keep repeating this phrase, but I think that has just traumatized that society. Beyond that, it's wide open. And I think any motivation out there that you can think of is probably going to be espoused by someone on that front line.
But wide open, that's all too hard to comprehend, because the world is intervening here. When you're intervening, you want a sense of what you're intervening on behalf of. Wide open?
I think the idea of some kind of managed transition after Colonel Gaddafi falls is, to me, a difficult prospect to imagine. It could happen. And I tell you, one thing that I've absolutely gotten wrong the past couple months is, you know, predictions. So I really don't know what's going to happen. But it's not you don't get a lot of comfort looking at the way the opposition is trying to form itself in Benghazi, the way the rebels fight on the front and Raslanov, Breger, Ajdabia. It's much more chaotic, I think, than we understand.
Now there's this offer, apparently, from Gaddafi's own sons, from the sort of reform wing of his, what is it, seven sons, I think, to say, look, let us take over and we'll navigate toward democracy. Does that look like, they don't say what they'll do with dad. It's not even clear if dad's in on this or not. Does that look like a farce to you? Does that look like an opening to some real change? Could the rebels ever imagine dealing with a son of Gaddafi?
You know, I think it's clear that Colonel Gaddafi can't last. And how he goes is, I think, you know, who knows? Does he, you know, it's hard for me to see him leaving the country, but, you know, short of that, what happens to him?
What makes that clear? Why do you say that's clear? There have been defections. On the other hand, the rebels seem to be, you know, being knocked back all over the place.
Yeah, it's why he can't stay or why he would never leave the country.
You say he won't stay. It seems unlikely that he'll stay. Well, why not?
It's hard for me to see him being able to reconquer eastern Libya at this point. It was hard for me to even see him retake Benghazi without an utter bloodbath that would be... You know.
But they're back at Brega, which is pretty far east.
It is a key
oil place. I mean, who's to say that he can't? Why couldn't he retake it?
You know, Brega, Raslanov, these are basically company towns. Mm-hmm. You know, hardly anyone lives
oil
there.
Oil towns.
Yeah, oil towns. Ajdabia is deserted, pretty much abandoned at this point. You know,
wow.
Benghazi is a serious city. It's the second largest mm-hmm. city in the country. It is, you know, almost uniformly opposed to Gaddafi. But even, let's say that they're, you know, let's say it's uniformly opposed to Gaddafi, even then you have people within that city that could make trouble. I mean, I think what we're looking for is more a prescription for anarchy and chaos in some respects. You pointed out the
sons. Is it Western air power? Excuse me, Tony.
No,
is it Western air power that would keep Gaddafi from retaking the east because they can just bomb the roads that are the access points there and until his troops can't get through?
I think so. And you enshrine a stalemate. And a stalemate, stalemate suggests, you know, that things are kind of stuck and not things happening. I think it could also suggest, you know, that the lines are drawn and, you know, and there's a certain entropy that takes place on both sides. I mean, the idea of each of the sons having his own basically militia to fight. I mean, these guys.
And is that the case, more or less?
Pretty much. And these guys aren't necessarily going to stay united. I mean, they may fight each other out for mm-hmm. power in Tripoli, say. And then you have out in the east where, as it becomes clearer and clearer that, you know, that there's going to be no breakthrough, that there's going to be no, you know, revolution or overthrow of Gaddafi, I think you're going to see fissures, cracks, you know, start to emerge in the east as well.
We'll look at what that might look like down the road. Christina in Cambridge, Massachusetts, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Tony Shadid. Christina.
Hi, Tom. I have a question for Mr. Shadid. He was talking earlier about when his captors made him lay down on his belly and he thought that was the end. I was wondering if it went through his mind at that moment, maybe I should just stand up and say, if you're going to kill me, just you have to look at me when you do it, because we have all of these romantic notions about dying with heroism. And I just wondered, in the moment, did any of that cross his mind, or was he just thinking about survival?
Sounds like Hollywood, Christina, but let's see. Let's see.
I've thought about that a lot. And I'll tell you, my colleague Steve Farrell was very insistent on maintaining eye contact the whole time. He thought the only way they weren't going to shoot us, you know, in the back of the head was if he maintained eye contact.
Hard to do that when you're laying face down in the desert, though.
It is. And I remember looking up at the people, and I was trying to follow the conversation mm-hmm. that was taking place. And that, you know, at one point, the soldier did say, shoot them, in Arabic. And then, you know, what to me felt like minutes, but again, I think it was just seconds, another person said, you can't, they're Americans. You know, I had been shot before, you know, while working. And the feeling that I had laying on my stomach, you know, a couple of weeks ago was the exact same feeling I had when I was laying in a street, you know, bleeding. And that is, you know, you're not, I mean, I wasn't frantic. It wasn't desperation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was more this kind of resignation that, you know, that the end was coming and you think about the last thoughts that you want to think about. And that was, you know, about my wife and my children. It almost sounds like a cliche, but, you know, it's funny how, like, in those, you know, and what you think might be the last moments of life, you know, the cliches still, you know, ring true.
And did you have any impulse to sort of get up off your belly? I don't know if you could if you were tied, but...
You know, to be honest, I think if I tried to run, I would have been shot immediately. Yeah. I think the only idea is that, you know, I was listening to the conversation, hoping for mercy at that point, and you know, in the end, you know, we weren't shot.
Let's shoot them. You can't. They're Americans. Why do you think they said that? Why would that protect you at that moment instead of the opposite?
You know, I tell you, I think there was a sense that we were worth something. And I hate to say, you know, I want to use that term without any value necessarily.
Mm-hmm,
I mean,
mm-hmm.
There's a horrific legacy of American involvement in the Arab world. you know, at times when we were stopped, people, you know, accused us of being, you know, as Americans, enemies of the Arabs, enemies of the Arab world. But at the same time, I think the idea of shooting three American journalists and a British journalist, but I think they assumed he was American. The idea of shooting them in some kind of, you know, dusty lot next to a house would be too big a decision to take on their own, that we were worth something, that had they shot us, there would have been repercussions and ramifications. And, you know, they might have gotten something out of us as prisoners.
Three men plus one young woman, Lindsay Addario. How did her treatment compare to yours as men?
You know, Lindsay was groped repeatedly. She was, you know, she was, I think, one of her deepest fears the whole time was that she would be separated from us. She was beaten in a way that I would not have imagined. I mean, even as she was blindfolded and handcuffed, we were sitting in the back of a truck and someone hit her in the face with a fist.
How does that go together with the hospitality and culture?
Right. You know, and I don't want to by any means, you know, say that we were treated well across the board. I think, but what did strike me is that it wasn't uniformly brutal, that there were moments where I think people did take pity on us and people did show us mercy. You know, on the other hand, we were sitting in the tarmac, defenseless, bound by hands and blindfolded, and, you know, someone hit me in the, you know, the back of the head with a rifle butt. You know, someone, Tyler got the same thing. I was headbutted at the very beginning. I mean, you know, it's a conflict, and I think conflict, you know, how do you put this, you know, that makes any sense? I mean, you know, violence is basically the vocabulary of conflict.
And there you were in the middle of it. There's still a debate over whether or not to arm the rebels. As you describe it, it seems like such a fractured thing that it's not at all clear what even that might mean exactly.
There's such a deep desire, I think, on the part of so many Libyans to have the society that would reflect what they see as, you know, as their worth. And I think a lot of people are embarrassed that they've had to live under four decades of just this, like I said, I keep using the word, but it's hard to describe it otherwise, this bizarre rule. You know, the people in Benghazi, it was, you know, there was moments of euphoria, there were moments of excitement and optimism. I think what we're dealing with, though, is this reckoning with, you know, a government that relentlessly stopped the building of any kind of institutions that could navigate a transition.
But it's hard to resist helping the people who are trying to end that government, to try and finally get out of those four decades, saying enough, enough. It's hard to say, I mean, well, a lot's been done already from the air, but then that's all we're going to do. Good luck. You deal with it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I have trouble seeing the end game on this. I mean, even if we did arm them, isn't it possible for them to march on Tripoli? I don't see that as possible. I see, in fact, you know, further splintering where, you know, when you refer to the rebels, you're actually referring to three, four, five, even a dozen groups. But what is, you know, if we don't arm them, then what is the end game? If we arm them, what is the end game? It's hard for me to see, like, again, I say the short term, medium term, you know, it's hard not to see this getting far messier.
And I just can't get over the feeling, Tony, of how good it is to be sitting with you here and not have you bound and blindfolded somewhere in the desert. Lots of comments here on Facebook. Judy says, no question, just gratitude. Being long familiar with his work, yours, Anthony Shadid, your capture felt personal, Judy says. I'm in awe of his and his colleagues' courage and dedication. We've got another one here from Emmanuel says, isn't the big reason we care about Libya more than other humanitarian atrocities is that because there is oil and profit for American speculators there? This is, you can find plenty of this online and around Anthony Shadid. What about it? There are many problems in the world, in Ivory Coast right now and elsewhere. People look at the involvement in Libya and say, it's oil.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's hard not to be cynical about, you know, about it at some level. I think if, you know, Libya had no oil, would there be an, you know, a no-fly zone over the country? I personally doubt it, but, you know, who's to say?
What about the argument that, and President Obama has made it, we could not let this sort of Arab Spring end in a bloodbath in Benghazi? That would have been wrong.
You know, and would there have been a bloodbath in Benghazi? I don't know about that. I mean, I don't.
Boy, that's a central assertion
all
over the place.
It is. And, would he have tried to retake it? He probably would have. Would he have tried to retake it by force, or would he have tried to let it fall apart? I mean, it's just hard to scout out. But I think there is a double standard at work. And, you know, I think, or critics, let me put it this way, critics would not be, you know, critics could contend that there is a double standard at work, that we're not seeing the same kind of concerted international action in other places like Yemen or Bahrain that we're seeing in Libya. You know, were France's and Italy's decisions to recognize the opposition as a legitimate government, were they, you know, only done on humanitarian grounds? Were they trying to position themselves for a post-Qaddafi, you know, landscape in Libya? I think that's possible too. So it is, you know, I guess it's hard to just see everything playing itself out right now through, you know, just by, you know, by force of sheer altruism.
On the Bahrain front, here's a question from Saeed. It says, please ask Anthony Shadid why the Arab world has been so quiet on the atrocities taking place in Bahrain. Even the much heralded Al Jazeera has reduced its coverage of the Saudi and Gulf Cooperation Council invasion of Bahrain, have been silent, says Saeed, on the daily killings. What about that? Have you seen Al Jazeera's complexion change as the Arab wave got closer to its home in Qatar? Yeah.
You know, I have deep respect for Al Jazeera and other Arab journalists. They've taken incredible risks, and I think they're often treated much more viciously than we are as Western journalists. I think Al Jazeera itself has, you know, played an incredibly dynamic role in, you know, everywhere from Tunisia, Egypt on. I do think Al Jazeera is also, though, susceptible to the pressure of the government, you know, the country it resides, Qatar. And I think the Qataris are, you know, having, there's an incredible amount of pressure being exerted on them from Saudi Arabia and elsewhere. There is deep fear in the Arab world about sectarian problems, Sunni Shiite problems. I think you're going to hear about that everywhere from Syria to Bahrain to Saudi Arabia and on. And I think Bahrain's conflict is very entrenched in that fear.
David in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. You're on the air with Anthony Shadid. David, thanks for calling.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I won't minimize Anthony Shadid's very disagreeable experience with the Qaddafi forces, and reporting is not a safe job in these situations.
Mm-hmm.
But I imagine, I don't know, but that a reporter has to keep himself sort of a little distant from what's going on so that he can do his job effectively. So I was wondering what Mr. Shadid felt like being in a position of a person who he is reporting on, how it felt like to be, you know, suffering like the victims of Qaddafi instead of just observing and reporting.
Under the guns, not flying through in any bubble of exemption. Though I guess it's not the first moment you may have felt that, Tony. But what about David's question?
You know, it's a good question. And I think, I guess, I mean, when you do this for so long, I mean, I've been a foreign correspondent in the Middle East for 15 years. You know, when I was in that jail cell in Sirte, the first thing I wanted to do was read all the graffiti on the wall. I wanted to try to get some
insight.
You
weren't the first person who had been locked up there.
That's right. And, you know, I did understand that I was having a, you know, I was having a perspective on this government that I wouldn't have had otherwise. And, you know, I think you always, you know, you remain a journalist. I think it also gave me maybe a little bit better insight into, you know, I've spent years in Iraq, and I've seen, I mean, I don't know how many countless times I've seen men blindfolded and handcuffed. You know, and I think I probably covered that a little too dispassionately. I didn't understand the, you know, the pain, just the very pain of that experience in its most mundane sense. And
mm-hmm.
It does give you a different perspective on it when you, you know, when you're blindfolded and handcuffed and you understand what, you know, these people that you've covered for so long are going through.
And there's no Turkish ambassador coming to get you out if you're in there.
That's exactly
so,
right.
In most people's circumstances. David, I appreciate your call. Joe in Newburyport, Massachusetts. Joe, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom, and hi to your guests. First of all, congratulations for surviving such an ordeal. I can't help but wonder, partly in awe, partly in respect, partly in just the why would someone put themselves, and the last caller kind of asked it, but why would someone put themselves in such a situation, yourself and your colleagues, number one, also the woman who got abused in Egypt back about 2 months ago, and why do they go in without security forces? If all these Halliburtons and everyone can hire security forces, why do you not go in with security forces? And why, if you have families, spouses, whatever, don't you think it's kind of, I kind of wonder if it's irresponsible of you, or should I have respect for you? Is there a social redeeming value for you going in, putting your lives at risk? Also, for our ambassadors and everyone to have to come in and rescue you, does it cost our taxpayers money? So I'm kind of wondering what the logic in your mind or heart is to want to continue to do this, and why you continually put yourself in harm's way, and why you don't have security forces to protect you while you're doing it.
Joe, I'll put that to Tony, but let me ask you first. I mean, you know, you're watching this with all the rest of us. We would know much less if there were not reporters there. Big decisions are being made about the extent of American and other involvement in this country. Let me turn it around to you just for a second before we go to Tony. Don't you want reporters on the ground telling you what's going on, Joe?
That's why I say I'm a little bit torn.
Partly
think it's irresponsible of them personally. I wouldn't want to put myself in that situation. And I say, well, partly kind of respect and awe that they will do that. But I just kind of, why would they risk themselves without security backing? And why do their organizations not, if they don't, have security backing with them?
Tony.
Like I said, I'm kind of torn.
Yeah, we hear it, Joe. Thanks.
And I think
Tony.
It's a perfectly legitimate question. I think, in its essence, you know, were we being irresponsible? And I don't know the answer to that, to be honest. You know, I've made some tough calls in the past. You know, in 2003, I decided to stay in Baghdad, unembedded during the American invasion. I took risks in 2006 when I covered the war between Israel and Lebanon. You know, there have been other moments where, you know, I felt that if I wasn't there, the story wouldn't be told otherwise. And I think that, I tell that to myself because I think it's the most altruistic reading of it. You know, if I'm not there, the story won't be told. Was that story in Ajdabiya the day that we got captured worth the risks we took? It absolutely was not worth the idea of someone being killed. And like I said, we don't know the fate of our driver, but if he was killed, then we're going to have to live with the burden that story was absolutely and utterly not worth it, and we took risks that got someone killed. I don't know. I don't think there is an easy answer to this. I don't call myself a war correspondent. I don't enjoy covering war. I do want to cover the Middle East, and I do find it very necessary and important to cover the Arab world. And when conflict becomes part of that story, then I feel obligated to cover it. But I think that question, were we being irresponsible or not, is one that's not easy to answer.
I want to pause on that perfectly legitimate question response. As a fellow journalist, I'm not so sure about that, but let's look at it. But on the mechanics, Joe says, why don't you go in with, Blackwater guards?
Right. You know, I tell you, this is one thing that I've seen change over the past 15 years as a foreign correspondent, is that progressively we are less and less identified as non-combatants. In other words, people that we cover often see us as part of the conflict somehow. And I think,
even if you're not carrying a gun, you're shaping the world's understanding of what's happening.
That's exactly right. And so I think just any kind of shred of reputation that we can maintain as non-combatants is very important. Did we have security advisors and consultants in Benghazi? We did. We didn't talk to them probably as much as we should have. But I think if to carry guards around with us will just make us look, I think, to the people we cover as just another militia.
And who's going to talk to you when you've got a Praetorian guard around you? The issue
Absolutely.
Of cost to the American government. Now, I don't know if there is any here. I think historically we've very much seen, if there were, I mean, after all, it's not like just somebody doing extreme sports out on a mountainside gets caught and therefore, or sailing irresponsibly in the Coast Guard. There's a reason that you're there, and the reason you're there has long been presumed to be of value to this country.
I would hope so. American diplomats did spend a lot of time on our case. The negotiations were protracted, and they were difficult and somewhat complicated, and we absolutely appreciate what they did for us. Just as you put it, we were hopefully doing something that was worthwhile and that was necessary, and that's part of our democracy. But again, was it worth the risk that we took on that day? I don't know that answer.
So when you say it's a perfectly legitimate question, as a journalist, fellow journalist who's been out there, Rwanda, Somalia, the Balkans, I kind of bridle at that. I mean, don't we need to know? How are we supposed to operate in this global community if we don't know what's happening there? And maybe it's I guess it's obvious that it's in some finely parsed way, you did ultimately take too much risk there. I guess the proof is in the pudding. You were taken captive. You could have died. On the other hand, if you're not somewhere near that front and we don't know what's happening, how are we ever going to know who the parties are, what their motivations are, what's going on?
And, Tom, I didn't see this as just another battle on another day. I did see this battle as somehow being decisive to the future of the conflict in Libya, but also, if you take a step back, also having a bearing on what was happening in the greater Arab world. I did see it as important. I think that what I'm wrestling with and what I'm struggling with, especially given the prospect that our driver may have died, is did I have enough already for that story, and did I need to stay as long as I did?
It's always that last mile. Joe, I appreciate your call. Kim in Rock Island, Illinois. You're on the air, Kim.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And happy to hear of your safe return to your caller. My point is I'm, to me, the Libyan people want democracy. We've always said in so many conflicts that that's what we were going in for. And to me, it's just great that we're there to help them. But instead of weapons, what about technology? I mean, as far as in so many ways, Twitter page was able to, people were able to group together and maybe do more of a peaceful,
It may be too late for that in Libya at this point, Kim, but I'll put it to Tony Shadid. I mean, Twitter uprisings in Tahrir Square and Tunisia. Are we way past that in Libya?
You know, I'll tell you, I mean, you know, Kim, as you said, I mean, young men with guns make me nervous, and they made me nervous in Iraq. They make me nervous in Libya. Seeing a lot of guns in a lot of places with not a lot of control, I don't think is a good sign for the future. You know, I'll tell you, my sense of it, just covering the Arab world right now, covering the Middle East, is that the easy ones are over. Egypt and Tunisia were places that had a very strong sense of shared national identity. They had institutions that could manage a transition, and they had, you know, a burst of energy and vitality that brought the revolutions to fruition very quickly. I think we're in for a long slog in these other places. I think we are going to see a far healthier, far more viable, far more interesting Arab world in the years ahead. But I think that, as Tom put it, the easy ones are over. Now we're in for a much longer slog that's going to be more violent, and with the stakes in some ways more far higher.
Maybe a long slog, but the stakes are shooting up right now, and the volatility seems to be shooting up. The United States pulling away from the Yemeni leader in Yemen, who's been an ally for such a long time. Do you see that one tipping over?
You know, I see these places that were, you know, engaging or disengaging. These are countries that are very complicated. Libya is in some ways less complicated than Yemen, for instance, or Bahrain or Syria. These are societies with deep conflicts, unresolved conflicts, and conflicts that are going to explode very quickly when this nominal control is removed from them. I think Yemen is probably going to be the first example of it.
You certainly have al-Qaeda. It's not disputed as in Libya.
That's right. And I think we want to keep our eye on Syria. I think Syria in some ways is as important as Egypt in terms of the dynamics and repercussions on the Arab world.
Could it possibly go? Could it blow up? Could Assad be? I mean, is that, you know, they've been there so long it seems unimaginable, but then so was Mubarak.
I mean, it's absolutely possible. I mean, I never thought, I guess I'm showing my own ignorance here, but I didn't expect Mubarak to go, or at least to go in the way he did. I mean, and that was, you know, I think any reporter who covered Cairo, covered the revolution in Egypt, did not walk away unbelievably moved by what they saw in Tahrir Square.
Can you still see the hopeful vision that was kind of lofted up by Tunisia and Egypt that, oh my gosh, here we go, the Arab wave is going to change the complexion of politics across this whole region? Is that still visible?
Absolutely.
I
remain deeply optimistic. I mean, I think what we're seeing right now is the Arab world speaking with an indigenous vocabulary, speaking with a sense of its own, you know, what it wants of itself. And that is something we haven't seen, I think, in past years. I think it becomes more complicated. I think the United States wants to think long and hard about what American intervention will mean for the fate of these, you know, revolutions, whatever we want to call them, uprisings, rebellions. Because I think what was so remarkable about Egypt and Tunisia is that these revolutions took place on their own terms. And I think that's one of the that's what gives you a sense of optimism, I think, looking forward.
But at the very end, the United States distancing itself very late, but nevertheless from Mubarak, may have played a role there. Is it going to have to make a decision every single time, or does it end up being a spectator, the United States here?
I think they got lucky in Egypt. They barely pulled it off.
Yes.
I mean, I don't know if we would say pulled it off even.
Or ended up on the right side of history.
That's right. That's right. I think this is going to take a lot of people, a lot of time at the National Security Council, the State Department, elsewhere in the U.S. government. This is going to be a full-time job for several years ahead. It's only getting started, I think, in some respects.
But do you see the United States as remaining at this kind of fulcrum of these things, or are events moving outside of critical American sway now?
You know, I think as long as Israel remains one of the United States' foremost allies, as long as Saudi Arabia remains the world's biggest exporter of oil, as long as we have bases sprinkled across the Persian Gulf, absolutely, the United States is going to remain deeply engaged in these conflicts and trying to navigate them in somewhat in one way or another. How much they can, I think, is another question, and I think we're seeing that in some ways in Libya, that we really haven't identified the end game in Libya. And I think that's just a sign of how complicated this is going to become as we go forward.
You say you're finally optimistic for the region. If it does get to something better, less autocracy, more democracy, where does that leave the United States? Is it still welcome? Is it still engaged? Or is it out?
That's a great question. And I think you're going to see a foreign policy from these countries, let's say Egypt, for instance, that reflects people's sentiments. And, they're not pro-Israel in Egypt. They're not, they weren't crazy about Camp David. There is a sense of sympathy for the Palestinians. I mean, these foreign policies are, I think, going to reflect the popular sentiments of the population. Now, is that going to make the United States, is it going to make it tougher for the United States? It is, but in some ways, I think it's also healthier. It's a society that, a government that reflects the sentiments of its people. I think that makes for healthier societies, healthier states, and it doesn't impose enmity necessarily between the United States and certain Arab countries. I think it just makes it more, in some ways, more complicated.
How long until you are back in the region with a notebook in hand and dust on your boots?
You know, that's the frustrating thing. I've been waiting to cover this for 15 years, and now it's finally underway. So I think I will probably head back, hopefully, to Lebanon and Egypt in a couple weeks.
Be safe. Be careful. Take care of yourself.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Anthony Shadid with us today, Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent for The New York Times, out of his captivity in Libya. Listeners, thank you for joining us this hour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.